The Federal News Update for Saturday, December 6th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson, and we are setting the stage for what is, I think, probably the most politically and administratively dense deep dive we have ever conducted. Our focus is absolutely laser sharp. Analyzing this whirlwind of activity from the U.S. federal government.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, and you know, our mission today is it's ambitious, but it's absolutely necessary. We're going to try to exhaustively analyze the granular details, the immediate impacts, and the long-term implications of every single recorded federal move that has happened since the clock struck midnight on Thursday, December 4th, 2025.
I have to say, you sent over the stack of sources, and reading through them, it's just so clear that the last 48 hours weren't just busy. They represent these sweeping fundamental shifts.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, we're looking at changes that span the constitutional limits of executive power, a radical new national security posture, the very fate of the career civil service, and even public health doctrine.
It's all connected.
It is. So for you, the learner, who needs a shortcut to understanding these dense, rapid-fire developments without, you know, drowning in all the jargon, this is your complete guide. We're going to start where the most power was gained: the judiciary and the constitutional landscape.
And we absolutely have to begin with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. On December 5, 2025, just yesterday, they issued a ruling that is, well, it's nothing short of a fundamental redefinition of the separation of powers. This decision consolidated two cases, Harris v. Bessent and Wilcox v. Trump.
Okay, let's really unpack this because this feels like a constitutional pivot point.
Yeah.
The core action here is that the D.C. Circuit upheld the president's power to remove officers of independent agencies, as long as those agencies are primarily exercising executive functions. And the decision specifically focused on the ability to fire the leadership of the Merit Systems Protection Board, the MSPB, and the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB.
And what's so fascinating here is just the sheer audacity of the legal reasoning. This ruling is essentially taking aim at, and you could argue it's dismantling, the nearly century-old precedent set by the 1935 Supreme Court case Humphrey's Executor v. United States.
Right.
For almost 100 years, Humphrey's Executor established that Congress could restrict the president's ability to remove officers of these independent agencies, the ones performing quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial functions. The whole idea was to insulate them from direct political pressure. You know, the logic was that these agencies, by being nonpartisan and independent, provided stability and competence.
So if I'm the listener, just tell me simply, what is the D.C. Circuit saying now?
They are saying that independence stops where executive power begins. Full stop. If an agency executes the law, if it enforces regulations, issues fines, or makes final decisions that affect the public, it is, in its essence, performing an executive function, no matter what its independent label says. And therefore, under this constitutional theory of the unitary executive, the president must have the power to supervise and remove its officers at will. Constitutional scholars are looking at this and saying it's one of the most significant judicially sanctioned expansions of presidential authority since the 1930s.
And the immediate implications for regulatory oversight and financial stability, they just feel immense. This logic, it immediately poses a direct threat to the independence of the most powerful financial regulators in the country.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
I mean, if the NLRB, which, you know, primarily handles labor disputes, if that exercises executive power, then the logic just naturally extends to giants like the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, and the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC.
Wow.
These bodies, they set monetary policy, they regulate these vast financial markets, they protect consumers. Their traditional independence relies completely on those specific for-cause removal protections.
Wait, if the Federal Reserve Board is now threatened, how does that functionally change the immediate landscape for monetary policy? Is this an immediate risk, or is it more of a long-term leverage thing?
It's both. It creates immediate leverage and a huge long-term risk. Functionally, this ruling extends an open invitation for the president to remove governors or commissioners who just disagree with the administration's current economic policy.
Right.
So for the Fed, which operates best when it's perceived as politically neutral, this just destroys that neutrality. Imagine a scenario where the president wants interest rates lowered before an election and the Fed resists. The president now has a much, much stronger legal position to simply replace the dissenting governors. It essentially converts these independent regulators into cabinet-level political appointees, and that just erodes market confidence and stability, which they rely on the Fed's insulation from election cycles.
But the internal impact, you know, the control over the federal government itself, is arguably even more transformative. This ruling, it seems to just neutralize the very check provided by the MSPB, which, for the listener, is essentially the appeals court for fired federal employees.
This is where the rubber meets the road for the career civil service. It's a perfect way to put it. If the president can fire the Merit Systems Protection Board judges who hear the appeals of career staff, then all the protections that were established by the Pendleton Civil Service Reform Act, which were designed specifically to prevent partisan firings, they're essentially moot.
They're gone.
This specific action facilitates the swift, unchallengeable implementation of civil service reclassification policies, like the proposed Schedule F designation. The administration could move to fire tens of thousands of career staff and not fear that those mass terminations will be reversed on appeal because the body handling the appeals is now politically subservient. It removes the bureaucratic firewall entirely.
And this is all just a precursor to the Supreme Court.
Precisely. This D.C. Circuit decision sets the stage for the highly anticipated Supreme Court argument in Trump v. Slaughter, which is scheduled for December 8th. That case specifically challenges the president's removal of an FTC commissioner. So the D.C. Circuit's decision is being seen as a really strong signal to the Supreme Court that the judicial branch is prepared to fully endorse a unitary executive theory, this idea that all executive power rests solely with the president.
Okay, moving from this foundational judicial shift to just unilateral executive action, we had a declaration drop on December 4th that sounds less like law and more like an immediate act of war against the previous administration's legacy, the Otto Penn Decree.
That is a perfect description. It really is. It's a targeted declaration that blends administrative law with this incredibly aggressive political strategy. President Trump issued a declaration asserting that all official acts signed by former President Joe Biden using an Otto Penn device are null, void, and of no further force or effect.
And the fine print here is in the rationale, which is just something else. I mean, Otto Penn use for routine signatures is common. It's been upheld by the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel as long as the president authorized the act. But this decree argues that Biden's use was unauthorized, not just by some administrative fiat, but because of his alleged cognitive decline. The argument is intensely philosophical. The president's mind did not accompany the hand of the machine, which renders the resulting acts constitutionally defective because they lacked the necessary executive deliberation.
And this is a devastatingly efficient legal weapon because it doesn't require new legislation. It doesn't require a long rulemaking process. It's designed to unravel specific past actions by targeting the method of signature. The primary target, according to sources close to the administration, is voiding the preactive pardons issued by Biden in his final days.
Which pardons are we talking about specifically?
We are talking about some very high-profile political figures and family members. James and Frank Biden, General Mark Milley, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dr. Anthony Fauci, and key members of the January 6th committee.
Wow.
By declaring the instruments of these pardons void ab initio, which means they were invalid from the very start, the administration clears the path for their potential prosecution without having to worry about these complex legal challenges related to the scope or timing of clemency.
The regulatory fallout from this one action alone must be causing absolute chaos across the federal bureaucracy.
It creates staggering regulatory uncertainty. I mean, just think about the scope. This declaration casts a legal shroud over thousands of statutes, executive orders, presidential proclamations, and federal appointments signed via Otto Penn between 2021 and 2025. What if you're a major corporation and you're being challenged by an environmental regulation issued during a Biden era? You now have an immediate, ready-made legal defense. You can simply argue the underlying executive order that established the regulation was never validly enacted because the signature was defective. It instantly creates massive litigation risk and paralysis for any policy that relied on an Otto Penn signature.
And just as we're processing the D.C. Circuit's unitary executive endorsement and this Otto Penn decree, the Supreme Court weighed in on December 5th, granting certiorari on the question of birthright citizenship.
Yes, the court agreed to hear Trump v. Barbara, which is the administration's direct challenge to the 14th Amendment's guarantee of citizenship for children born in the U.S. This all stems from an executive order that was signed on President Trump's first day in office, aimed at ending birthright citizenship for the children of undocumented immigrants and temporary visa holders.
The constitutional stakes here aren't just high. They are. They're fundamental to American identity. By granting review, the Supreme Court is signaling its readiness to reconsider that critical phrase in the 14th Amendment, subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
And the administration's legal theory is quite sophisticated. It relies on a very narrow reading of that clause. They're positing that subject to the jurisdiction thereof requires a complete political allegiance, which they argue undocumented immigrants and temporary visitors, like diplomatic staff or those on temporary work visas, simply do not possess. This theory directly challenges the 1898 precedent of United States v. Wong Kim Ark, which has served as the bedrock of birthright citizenship for well over a century. A ruling in the administration's favor would be a tectonic shift.
So if the court rules in favor of the administration, which could happen as early as June 2026, what are the massive operational bottlenecks you mentioned for the average citizen? What does that actually look like?
Well, just imagine the administrative nightmare. The State Department and the Social Security Administration would instantly be required to establish these complex, costly, and resource-intensive mechanisms to vet the immigration status of both parents before they issue essential documents like U.S. passports or Social Security numbers to any newborn.
So every birth would trigger a review?
Every single one. Right now, proof of birth in the U.S. is usually sufficient. In this scenario, every birth certificate would require a legal review of parental status. Furthermore, and this is a severe human cost, millions of children who are currently U.S. citizens could lose eligibility for crucial federal safety net benefits, including Medicaid and the SNAP-P food assistance program. That would effectively shift the massive cost and burden of supporting these children onto already overwhelmed state and local governments.
And before we leave this topic, we also saw the administration leverage some of these administrative tools to continue the targeted purge of employees within the Department of Education, specifically within the Office for Civil Rights, or OCR.
This really highlights the strategy of what you could call a soft purge. The department issued these very confusing notices to numerous OCR employees who had been placed on administrative leave nearly 8 months prior as part of a reduction in force, or a RIF.
And for the listener, what does it mean for a RIF notice to be told?
Told is legal jargon. It just means the clock on the notice has been paused due to pending litigation. So these employees were abruptly ordered to return to work on specific dates, December 15 or 29, 2025, even though the litigation challenging the RIF itself is still active. The agency claims the return is necessary to prioritize OCR's existing complaint caseload.
But the union sees it differently.
Oh, union representatives have vehemently characterized this as strategic harassment. After months of uncertainty, these employees have likely relocated. And the demand to return to physical offices in Washington, D.C. on such short notice effectively forces a large segment of the staff who can't or won't return to just resign. This targets the very division responsible for enforcing Title IX and federal anti-discrimination laws. It achieves the staffing reduction the RIF aimed for, but by forcing attrition rather than formal termination.
The pace of these constitutional and administrative changes is just breathtaking. Let's pivot now to the global stage in national security, because the U.S. foreign policy playbook has, it seems it has just been completely rewritten.
The new national security strategy, the NSS, released by the White House on December 4th, represents a radical reorientation of U.S. foreign policy. It's one that moves explicitly away from the traditional post-World War II transatlantic alliance framework.
Let's talk about the specific language, because the sources noted that the strategy explicitly adopts the rhetoric of the European far right.
That's really the most alarming part. The document warns that Europe faces civilizational erasure within the next two decades because of its current migration and integration policies. This is not standard diplomatic language. This is a direct echo of the Great Replacement conspiracy theory, which has now been elevated to the status of official U.S. strategic doctrine. It fundamentally changes how the U.S. views its relationship with key allies like Germany and France.
So this moves far beyond just expressing disagreement with, say, EU trade policies. This is a commitment to direct intervention in the internal political workings of European nations.
Precisely. The strategic directives inside the NSS commit the U.S. to cultivating resistance to Europe's current trajectory within European nations. This is widely interpreted as a directive for U.S. diplomatic and even intelligence resources to actively identify, fund, and support nationalist and Eurosceptic political parties and movements that are aligned against the established Brussels EU power structure. The document explicitly characterizes the EU's activities as undermining political liberty and sovereignty. It views the EU as a competitor, not a partner.
So the U.S. is now strategically opposed to the very foundation of the European Union.
And that opposition comes with a heavy economic price tag for Europe. The document demands that Europe open its markets significantly to U.S. goods, and critically, it shifts the primary responsibility for their own collective defense entirely onto European nations. The implication is clear. The U.S. security umbrella, particularly NATO support, is no longer guaranteed or free. It's now contingent upon major economic concessions to the U.S.
And while the foreign policy doctrine shifts outward, we need to turn inward to the Pentagon, where Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is under some intense scrutiny following the findings of a Pentagon watchdog regarding his communication security.
This is the so-called SignalGate incident, and it's all related to the use of the encrypted messaging app, Signal. The Pentagon Inspector General, the IG, found that Secretary Hegseth put U.S. personnel and the mission itself at risk by using the app to convey sensitive pre-operational details about strikes against Houthi militants in Yemen.
What specifically was the risk created by using this app? I mean, it's encrypted, right?
Right, but the fine print of the investigation revealed that Hegseth reportedly shared the exact timings of warplane launches and when bombs would drop regarding these strikes. He shared this information in a group chat that included unauthorized individuals, including a journalist who was reportedly not cleared for such sensitive operational data. Critically, these details were shared before the pilots carrying out the attacks were airborne and over the target. So this created a window for the enemy to potentially exploit the information, which led lawmakers, including the Republican Senate Armed Services Committee chairman, to suggest this behavior would be a fireable offense for any lower-ranking officer in the military chain of command.
It sounds like the IG investigation was driven by concerns from both sides of the aisle, then.
It was. The IG investigation was opened at the request of the Republican chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator Roger Wicker, and the top Democrat, Senator Jack Reed. Their bipartisan concern really highlights that this isn't just a political disagreement, it's a failure of operational security. Yet the White House continues to stand firmly by the secretary.
How do they even rationalize such a high-risk security failure?
Well, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt issued a statement asserting that the probe confirms that no classified information was leaked and operational security was not compromised. This defense relies heavily on the administration's ability to retroactively rationalize the communication, you know, perhaps by claiming the information was unclassified at the time or that the operational integrity wasn't technically breached because the mission succeeded. It's a defense that elevates the loyalty of the appointee over adherence to standard military communications security protocols.
And the second incident involving the secretary is arguably even more legally fraught, tied to the lethal strikes on alleged drug boats in the Caribbean.
The IG also investigated the follow-up strike in the Caribbean on September 2nd on an alleged drug smuggling vessel. This centers on the very serious allegation that Secretary Hegseth issued a verbal order to kill everybody regarding survivors or those attempting to escape from the sinking vessel. And Southern Command confirmed just this Thursday that a 22nd strike had occurred, killing four so-called narco-terrorists.
What's the legal question here regarding the survivors?
The scrutiny remains intense over the legality of striking survivors who may be helpless or clinging to wreckage. The legality depends heavily on how the operation is classified. Is it a military engagement under the laws of armed conflict? Or is it a civilian police action, like drug interdiction? If it's a military action, the rules of engagement are different than if it is a police action under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, where taking lethal action against non-threatening individuals is strictly prohibited. Hegseth claimed he did not see survivors and defended his order as relating to the fog of war, but critics contend that the order, if it's verified, may cross the line into an unlawful command.
The national security agenda is also driving this massive escalation in immigration and border policy actions that took place over this 48-hour window.
Yes, we saw two major synchronized moves, expanding the travel ban and escalating domestic enforcement to levels we haven't seen before. The administration significantly expanded the travel ban to over 30 nations. Confirmed additions include Afghanistan, Haiti, Iran, Somalia, Venezuela, Yemen, alongside Chad, Eritrea, and Sudan.
And the practical consequence of being placed on this list is immediate.
Immediately. All asylum decisions and visa applications from citizens of these nations have been halted indefinitely. Furthermore, we saw multiple reports surface that naturalization ceremonies for legal residents who hail from these specific banned countries are being postponed or canceled entirely. The justification cited by the administration is the inability of these nations to properly vet their citizens and concerns over potential terrorist threats.
There was also an interesting new directive targeting foreign tech workers, wasn't there?
Yes, the State Department issued instructions to diplomatic missions to begin screening visa applicants for complicity in censorship. This effectively bars employees of foreign tech firms, social media platforms, or even certain non-governmental organizations who have enforced specific content or hate speech codes from entering the U.S. It's a move that targets the employees of companies that the administration views as politically antagonistic abroad.
Domestically, the enforcement operations are aggressively ramping up, signaling an unprecedented push to deport hundreds of thousands of people.
We saw the launch of Operation Catahoula Crunch in New Orleans, with the stated plan to round up some 500,000 immigrants. Simultaneous enforcement operations are underway in Minneapolis, specifically targeting the large Somali community there, which followed news of a $1 billion COVID fraud scheme. These raids are sparking major pushback because critics point to the government's own data. ICE data shows that 73% of detainees they hold have no prior criminal convictions, yet they are being targeted for removal, often taken from their homes or streets purely for immigration violations.
And this immigration focus was tied directly to a major political move: the pardon of Texas Democratic Congressman Henry Queller and his wife.
This was a highly tactical use of executive clemency. Queller, a moderate Democrat known for his alignment with the administration's stance on border issues, and his wife were facing serious federal bribery and conspiracy charges related to accepting $600,000 in bribes from foreign entities. The president issued the pardon, explicitly defending it by stating Queller was prosecuted because he bravely spoke out against the Biden border catastrophe.
So this is using the pardon power to secure political loyalty and influence congressional leverage.
Absolutely. The move uses the extraordinary power of clemency to reward a political ally, potentially making a key Democratic vote less vulnerable to a GOP primary challenge or a general election challenge. It frames the entire ethics issue around alignment with border policy rather than ethical misconduct, and it secures political capital in the process.
We did see some legislative counteraction in this space with Congresswoman Jayapal reintroducing the Dignity for Detained Immigrants Act.
Yes, she's aiming to cut down on automatic ICE detention for low-risk groups and phase out the use of for-profit detention centers. Jayapal cited the enormous cost. Republicans included an unprecedented $45 billion more for ICE detention beds in the Big Beautiful Bill Act, and the data showing that the vast majority of those detained have minor or no criminal convictions. She argues that detaining low-risk individuals is a waste of taxpayer money and a moral failure, especially when they could be released on alternatives to detention.
Let's transition now from the political and judicial shakeups to the digital and technological front, where the federal government is grappling with both threats and its own modernization failures.
The digital threat landscape took a pretty significant leap this week with CISA, that's the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, issuing a critical advisory on December 5th about a sophisticated new malware called Brickstorm.
And this is not just low-level criminal activity. This is confirmed to be state-sponsored.
That's right. Nick Anderson, who is CISA's Executive Assistant Director for Cybersecurity, explicitly stated that Brickstorm underscores the grave threats posed by the People's Republic of China to our critical infrastructure. It has impacted at least 8 organizations, including multiple federal agencies and major IT companies that serve the government.
Walk us through the specific technical capabilities of Brickstorm. I mean, what makes it so concerning compared to other state-sponsored attacks?
The sources really dive into the depth of its stealth and its resilience. CISA described Brickstorm as having advanced functionality to conceal its communications, which makes it extremely difficult to spot on the network. Crucially, it has sophisticated lateral movement capabilities, allowing it to move easily from one compromised system to another, and it can tunnel into victim networks to hide its command and control channels. Perhaps most concerning is its ability to automatically reinstall or restart itself if it's disrupted by IT staff or security software. This enables, and I'm quoting CISA here, long-term access, disruption, and potential sabotage of critical infrastructure. That means the Chinese government could decide to trigger physical destruction or massive system failure months or even years down the road. CISA urged agencies to implement the detailed indicators of compromise they provided immediately.
And moving from external threats to internal failures, the Department of Defense is still struggling to get its financial house in order, specifically concerning property tracking.
This is about that persistent challenge of achieving a clean audit, something the Pentagon has struggled with for decades. The Pentagon Inspector General found that DOD's Corrective Action Plan to Reliably Track Government-Furnished Property, GFP, these are assets the government provides to contractors, which can range from machine tools to high-tech sensors. That plan is failing. And this failure puts their crucial 2028 clean audit goal in serious risk.
Why is tracking this property so difficult? Where is the breakdown?
Well, the required fix relies on integrating data into the GFP module within the Procurement Integrated Enterprise environment. But the implementation has just stalled dramatically. It's due to both management oversight and technical complexity. The IG noted a critical lack of enforcement from the Office of the Secretary of Defense, meaning there is no centralized pressure to comply. Furthermore, each military service, Army, Navy, Air Force, uses its own distinct legacy accountable property system of record, or APSR. Connecting all those disparate, siloed APSR systems to the department-wide GFP module is technically arduous and time-consuming, and it denies the department a crucial enterprise-level view of trillions of dollars worth of property held by contractors.
Shifting to more forward-looking technology, artificial intelligence is clearly a central focus for modernization, particularly within the Department of Health and Human Services.
Yes. HHS unveiled a new strategy to aggressively expand AI adoption across its operations, focusing on creating a centralized data infrastructure and enabling rapid deployment of AI tools. Their goal is to improve everything from processing Medicare claims to identifying public health trends more quickly.
But the use of AI in healthcare immediately raises these profound questions about sensitive patient data. What are the experts worrying about here?
The primary concern is regulatory protection. While there are clear safeguards under IPA for individual patient records, there are far fewer protections currently for large aggregated medical information sets that are analyzed by AI tools. Experts are questioning how HHS plans to ensure that the rapid deployment of these AI systems does not inadvertently expose sensitive medical data, especially since Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s base often voices concerns about tech company access to personal information. The consensus among experts is that HHS has to align records governance and data quality standards before deployment, or they risk automating bias and massive privacy breaches.
And on the military side, the U.S. is taking concrete steps to build the AI workforce of the future.
We saw a specific educational initiative launched this week. Virginia Tech and Amazon Web Services, AWS, started the first generative AI training program of its kind offered specifically at a senior military college. This program serves Virginia Tech's Corps of Cadets and National Security Institute affiliates. The pilot included 75 students, and it directly supports the White House AI Action Plan mandate, which aims to turn military colleges into national innovation hubs for developing AI talent ready for future military and government service. It's an explicit strategy to rapidly upskill the next generation of defense leaders.
None of these tech leaps can happen without steady, long-term funding. Congress is actively fighting to reauthorize and extend the Technology Modernization Fund, or TMF, through the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA.
Reauthorizing the TMF is essential for addressing the technical debt across the federal government, for strengthening cybersecurity, and for improving high-impact systems like benefits processing and critical infrastructure monitoring. Industry groups like ADI are advocating strongly for a 7-year extension, arguing that this is the minimum time needed to provide the long-term certainty necessary for these transformational modernization programs that otherwise get trapped in the yearly, highly politicized budget cycles. Without that long-term view, agencies are just forced to constantly patch legacy systems rather than replacing them.
And the White House has also proposed a novel solution for securing that long-term TMF funding outside of the direct appropriation battles.
That's the OMB proposal. It suggests a new TMF funding model that would allow the General Services Administration, GSA, to collect up to $100 million annually in otherwise expired funding. You know, money agencies didn't spend within the fiscal year, and transfer it directly to the TMF. This revolving fund structure is intended to give the TMF a reliable, flexible source of resources to address technology challenges, improve AI adoption, and support cross-government scalable services without constantly relying on Congress for new cash infusions.
Let's move from the technological infrastructure to the human infrastructure. The federal workforce and the management issues that just exploded this week.
One of the most critical announcements impacting millions of Americans came from the Social Security Administration, the SSA. They plan a massive reduction in service access.
What are the numbers here? It sounds like a severe cut.
It's extreme. The SSA plans a 50% cut in the number of visits to its field offices for fiscal year 2026, targeting no more than 15 million field office visits. That's a drastic drop from the 31.6 million visits recorded in the previous year.
And this target comes directly on the heels of major staffing reductions.
Precisely. This follows at least 7,000 SSA workers being laid off this year. The agency's official explanation is that modernization and technology improvements, including online portals and better phone service, allow them to serve more Americans at quicker speeds without in-person assistance. However, advocates, particularly those who work with the elderly and low-income populations, are sounding very loud alarm bells.
So if you, the listener, had to verify documents for a complex retirement or disability claim, where would you go if the field office closes? That's the real human impact here, isn't it?
Exactly. Advocates fear this signals inevitable widespread field office closures, harming the most vulnerable populations. These are people who lack reliable technology resources or who struggle specifically with online ID verification systems like login.gov, which often requires precise document scanning or difficult to recall security questions. Many complex applications for disability, for example, require in-person help to navigate the paperwork. A union leader bluntly stated that the SSA appears to want to allow AI and the internet to replace a well-trained, well-vetted workforce, which essentially creates a two-tiered system of service based on digital literacy.
And this feeds directly into the concerns about the politicization of the civil service. We now have a lawsuit showing that the administration's purge extended to employees who had already left roles related to diversity, equity, and inclusion.
A highly significant lawsuit was filed this week claiming that federal employees who transitioned out of these DEI roles before the Trump administration purge even began were still targeted and fired. The total number affected is estimated to be potentially in the thousands, including at least 40 women or non-binary individuals and more than 40 people of color.
Give us the specific mechanism of the firing. How did this work?
The lead plaintiff in the case is OPM's former deputy DEI director. Importantly, she had moved to a general human resources role director of the Talent Innovation Group months before the official DEI purge began. Yet she was placed on administrative leave and eventually fired. The central allegation of the lawsuit is that the administration is targeting individuals based on assumptions about their political beliefs or their previous associations, not their current job function or performance.
And what's a consequence of targeting based on political assumptions?
The lawsuit alleges that this politically motivated targeting is actively hurting the delivery of critical, nonpartisan federal services. They cite specific examples, including delays in veterans' benefits access and disruptions in border intelligence gathering, because experienced, competent personnel were removed based on past roles or perceived political leanings. This just underscores the lack of an institutional check, particularly since their appeals to offices like the MSPB have stalled, which aligns perfectly with the judicial shifts we discussed earlier.
In a related management move, OPM issued a memo that seemed aimed at calming fears among managers about their personal liability when they discipline staff.
Yes. On December 4th, OPM issued a clarification memo regarding the extremely limited scope for federal managers to be held individually responsible when disciplining employees for poor performance. This was a direct response to widespread managerial hesitation to issue reprimands or fire poorly performing staff due to fear of lawsuits.
What's the clarification OPM offered?
The memo states clearly that performance actions, things like implementing a performance improvement plan or a PIP, a demotion, or a removal, are considered the action of the agency, not the individual manager. Therefore, the agency, not the manager, is responsible for responding to employee challenges. Managers are only held personally liable for a gross misuse of authority, specifically discrimination, harassment, or prohibited personnel practices related to whistleblowing. And to reinforce this, OPM announced new mandatory one-hour online training for all federal supervisors.
While domestic agencies are dealing with these purges and efficiency goals, the diplomatic corps at the State Department is grappling with a severe morale crisis that directly affects U.S. foreign policy capacity.
A union-led survey of the Foreign Service found that nearly all employees report significantly lower morale, characterizing the situation as a workplace crisis. This is a direct consequence of resource and staffing cuts. Specifically, 78% of respondents reported operating under reduced budgets, and over 60% are managing significantly higher workloads due to staffing losses, which follows a mandated hiring freeze and the elimination of key offices.
So if your diplomatic corps is burned out and understaffed, how does that affect high-priority areas like Gaza or strategic competition with China?
It creates enormous vulnerability. The lack of resources and available staff directly affects the State Department's ability to operate effectively in high-priority areas. It diverts resources and slows down diplomatic response times related to the war in Gaza, managing support for Ukraine, and navigating strategic competition with China. Union leadership warns that American diplomacy is weaker because of this politicization, noting that talented career diplomats are avoiding service because they fear political targeting, a vulnerability which U.S. adversaries are all too happy to exploit in sensitive negotiations.
We did see one small piece of good news for some federal employees this week, specifically blue-collar DOD workers.
Yes, finally. Tens of thousands of blue-collar Defense Department workers under the federal wage system are slated to receive their long-delayed 2024 pay raises. This raise had been stalled for nearly a year because Defense Secretary Hegseth's earlier purge of advisory committees had halted the DOD Wage Committee from approving new wage schedules. The committee finally reconvened and met last week after mounting political pressure from lawmakers, allowing the raises to finally be processed.
And on a more subtle but significant social policy change, the Justice Department made a quiet move regarding the Prison Rape Elimination Act, or PREA.
This is a major policy shift, and it affects one of the most vulnerable populations in the criminal justice system. The DOJ issued a memo to federal prison inspectors directing auditors to ignore specific PREA standards that protect LGBTQ plus inmates, particularly transgender women, from sexual abuse and harassment. These standards include housing directives intended to ensure safety. This memo effectively removes those particular federally mandated protections under PREA for this vulnerable population, and it's led to immediate alarm from civil rights organizations.
This takes us seamlessly into our final section, covering public policy, the economic context, and the looming battles in Congress.
Let's start with the massive public policy deadline that Congress is just barreling toward, the expiration of health care subsidies.
The Enhanced Affordable Care Act, the ACA, premium tax subsidies, are set to expire in January. This threatens massive cost increases for millions of families.
We're talking about 24 million Americans facing potential premium increases ranging between 24% and a staggering 50%. The current enhanced subsidies made healthcare affordable for many low and middle income families, and their abrupt end could lead to millions dropping coverage entirely because of the cost.
The political maneuvering to avoid this cliff is intense, with House Democrats attempting an end run around leadership.
Absolutely. House Democrats have signed a discharge petition with 214 members, which means they only need four Republicans to bypass Speaker Johnson and force a floor vote on a subsidy extension. Senate Democrats, sensing the political vulnerability, are promising a floor vote next week. This puts immense pressure on moderate Republicans, especially those who represent districts with high ACA enrollment.
And Republicans, meanwhile, lack a unified alternative plan, which leaves them vulnerable to attacks on healthcare affordability.
That's their central problem. While some Republicans are proposing converting the subsidy funding into health savings account, or HSA, contributions, arguing it encourages consumer-driven care, there is no consensus or finalized legislative text ready to go. This division has led key Republican strategists, including Senator Tom Tillis, to warn that a failure to address these soaring premiums is going to be a major political problem in the 2026 midterms, regardless of who is in the White House.
And this political fight is happening against a backdrop of sweeping public health doctrine changes spearheaded by the administration.
On December 5th, the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, a body that has been handpicked by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., voted 8-3 to end the universal hepatitis B vaccine administration for newborns, a policy that had been in place since 1991.
This is a major fundamental recalibration of the core childhood vaccine schedule. What's the new standard?
The new standard is that the birth dose is now recommended only for infants born to mothers who test positive for the virus. For infants born to mothers who test negative, the decision is now moved to, quote, shared clinical decision-making, starting the series at 2 months. The administration also issued a presidential memorandum directing the CDC to conduct a comprehensive review of the entire U.S. core childhood vaccine schedule, explicitly seeking to align it with what it calls superior international practices, which generally recommend vaccines for fewer diseases than the U.S. currently includes.
Critics are concerned that this move effectively privatizes risk assessment and could reverse decades of public health progress in eradicating infectious diseases.
That's the core tension. Senator Bill Cassidy, who is a physician, publicly called the Hep B decision a profound mistake, noting that the universal birth dose contributed to a 99% decline in hepatitis B cases among children and young adults. The administration is essentially dismantling the one-size-fits-all mandate, framing it as restoring parental choice, even as public health experts warn it endangers millions of children by increasing the overall risk of disease spread in communities.
Moving back to economic policy and manufacturing, the administration approved the domestic manufacturing of tiny cars this week, following the rollback of Biden-era vehicle fuel economy standards.
This is a dual action focused entirely on reducing consumer costs. The rollback of the strict fuel economy standards is expected to save the typical consumer over $1,000 per car and result in $109 billion in total savings over 10 years, framing the action as a necessary reduction in costs driven by excessive regulation.
And the tiny car approval is part of that same effort to deliver cheaper vehicle options.
Exactly. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy confirmed that NHTSA is clearing the regulatory rules to allow microcars, sometimes known as key cars, to be built domestically. He noted that these vehicles, which are common in Europe and Asia, are safe, inexpensive, and likely ideal for congested city driving, though they're probably not suitable for high-speed freeway travel. This is a direct policy response catering to an audience focused on low cost of living and anti-regulatory action.
Let's dive briefly into the arcane world of federal contracting, where a key legal decision dropped this week concerning the timing of contract protests. This is a vital lesson for businesses dealing with the government.
It absolutely is. The Court of Federal Claims rejected a post-award protest from Active Deployment Systems, or ADS, which had challenged ICE's strategy of awarding many indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity, or IDIQ contracts for detention services.
What's the crucial legal takeaway from this decision for government contractors?
The court underscored that disputes over solicitation language, pricing structures, or the terms of the contract must be raised before the bidding process closes. That's known as a pre-award protest, not after the contract has been awarded. Contractors can't wait until they lose or win a lucrative task order to complain about the fundamental rules they already agreed to. Agencies are increasingly using this strategy awarding IDIQs to essentially everyone who submitted a responsive offer, thereby reducing the grounds for a major protest as a protest management technique. This pushes potential disputes down to the task order level, which is much more limited in scope and jurisdiction, and it significantly limits a contractor's ability to challenge the overall contracting strategy.
Finally, we need to cover the ongoing political battle for control of Congress, which is playing out through the courts and state legislatures via relentless redistricting efforts.
On December 4th, the Supreme Court allowed Texas to use a congressional map, blocking a lower court decision that had challenged the boundaries. This map significantly boosts GOP efforts to maintain control of the House of Representatives by solidifying Republican seats and diluting Democratic strength, particularly in urban areas.
And Indiana is following suit with a mid-decade redistricting effort targeting Democratic strongholds.
Yes, the Indiana House passed a redistricting bill on December 5th aimed at redrawing the lines of the state's only two Democratic seats. This measure, now heading to the state Senate, is a mid-decade effort, meaning it's happening outside the typical post-census cycle, and it's facing fierce criticism. Opponents claim the proposed map will dilute the political power of black voters and split Indianapolis into four sprawling districts, furthering the aggressive gerrymandering push seen nationwide to lock in partisan advantages regardless of population shifts.
In just 48 hours, we have analyzed seismic changes across the federal government. Yep. I mean, we saw the core institutional structure change from the highest court's willingness to entertain overturning birthright citizenship to a massive expansion of presidential removal power over independent agencies and a total reorientation of U.S. foreign policy toward Europe.
What stands out most when you look at this stack of actions is the systematic, determined neutralization of the institutional checks that traditionally slowed down radical policy shifts. Independent boards like the MSPB, scientific consensus within the CDC's vaccine recommendations, the traditional independence of the diplomatic corps, they have all been brought under a greater degree of centralized, unilateral executive control. The system is designed to accelerate change.
So if we connect the D.C. Circuit ruling confirming the president's sweeping new removal powers with the ongoing purge of the civil service from DEI roles to OCR staff and even the SSA, what are the long-term implications for governance? It feels like it's more than just a political difference.
This raises an essential, almost existential question for you, the learner. If the Merit Systems Protection Board, the body explicitly designed to protect career staff from political retaliation and ensure they can act with impartiality and competence, is now functionally under direct executive control, does the traditional nonpartisan federal career exist anymore? Or has the principle of loyalty officially replaced the fundamental principle of competence as the governing value in the federal bureaucracy? That is a foundational challenge to the structure of the American Republic that has crystallized over these intense 48 hours, and it's one we will certainly continue to explore.